When we left off in episode 4, it was 1974. Jeffrey McDonald had just finished addressing the grand jury in North Carolina. His statement was, as we noted, rambling and long-winded, but it included a critique of the Army's investigation into the murder of his family that, under scrutiny, stood up fairly well. You wouldn't know that, however, from reading Joe McGinnis's description of McDonald's statement. Rather than fact-checking McDonald, as we did, McGinnis only intrudes upon McDonald's statement once to observe,
"McDonald's tone, as he continued, became increasingly aggrieved. What he seemed to want most to communicate to the grand jurors was the unfairness of it all."
This type of comment is a subtext that McGinnis threads early in Fatal Vision and continues weaving across the text until, in Chapter 2 of Part 4, it becomes visible to the reader. That is, the reader begins to see more clearly that McDonald, despite an appearance of relative normality, is actually something closer to a subtly constructed reflex machine which can mimic the human personality perfectly, to quote from Hervey Cleckley's 1941 book The Mask of Sanity, as McGinnis himself does in the conclusion of Fatal Vision. But as early as the introduction, McGinnis is already hinting at this theme. For example, in recounting his first meeting with McDonald in June 1979 in Southern California, McGinnis writes,
"After the meal, Jeffrey McDonald took me back to his condominium. There was a jacuzzi just off his master bedroom. Wall-to-wall carpeting. A lot of glass. Glass-topped tables, sliding glass doors, and large mirrors lining the walls. I had never before been in a home in which such a large percentage of wall space had been given over to mirrors."
It's almost as if McDonald was in love with his own reflection, a la Narcissus. McGinnis artfully circles back to the mirrors theme in the conclusion when discussing his post-conviction return to McDonald's condominium later the same year.
"Jeffrey McDonald's condominium was quite comfortable, once I got used to all the mirrors. Mirrors, 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 mirrors,
mirrors." Similar asides are sprinkled throughout Fatal Vision, such that the reader slowly comes to suspect McDonald, though perhaps not in a manner that can be easily articulated. In a stroke of genius, McGinnis anticipates the complaint among his more discerning readers that they are being winked, nodded, and nudged into accepting McDonald's guilt, rather than being argued to this conclusion by a dispassionate presentation of the evidence. Preempting this critique, McGinnis splices the text of Fatal Vision with the voice of Jeffrey McDonald, a voice reconstructed from cassette tapes containing a prolific stream of autobiographical reminiscences which McDonald smuggled out of prison after his 1979 conviction and arranged to be delivered to McGinnis. To be clear, the idea for the cassettes was McGinnis's, not McDonald's. Nevertheless, McDonald, at least under McGinnis's editorial control, did a fine job all on his own of convincing the reader that he was, at a minimum, a vain and shallow, if also bright and ambitious, man. This made McGinnis's work in convincing the reader of McDonald's guilt considerably easier. Vanity and ambition are a notoriously volatile cocktail. Stir in a pinch of psychopathy, and you might even get murder. I'm your host, Matthew Craig Kelly. Welcome back to The Looking Glass.
"And the wheel of destiny has turned. The survival of peace and freedom will be determined by whether the American people have the moral stamp.
5, 4.
The great
four,
silent three, majority.
Castle. Drive.
Dustin Morgan composed the music and sound design for this episode. Our cast this episode features Chad Danella as Dr. Jeffrey McDonald, Brian Covault as Joe McGinnis, Angela Featherstone as Juror Number 1, Jeffrey David Harvey as the former Chief of Psychiatry at Walter Reed Army Hospital, Josh T. Pearson as Victor Warheide, Stephen Heller as the 2nd Army Psychiatrist, Charity May as Juror Number 2, and Yeshaya Blakeney as the 3rd Psychiatric Witness. You can follow us on Facebook at The Looking Glass True Crime Podcast and on Instagram at TheLookingGlass_podcast. We will be posting Season 1 related documents, photographs, and short essays regularly at both of these accounts. Follow us on YouTube and TikTok at The Looking Glass True Crime. If you enjoy the podcast, please subscribe and give us a 5-star review. We appreciate your support. In relating the grand jury episode to his readers, McGinnis continues building toward the psychopathy theme. He notes that after McDonald finished testifying in the summer of 1974, he
returned to California, but the grand jury remained in session until January of 1975. More than 75 witnesses testified. Gradually, a picture of Jeffrey McDonald began to emerge. The context into which the grand jurors could place the man they had seen and the story they had heard during McDonald's week on the witness stand.
A sizable portion of the testimony and corresponding picture to which McGinnis attends in the pages that follow is given over to Warheide's questioning of two psychiatrists and a clinical psychologist. This testimony is critical to McGinnis's effort to impress upon the reader McDonald's psychological abnormality. I cannot say how these passages read in 1983, when Fatal Vision was originally published. But today they read like a remarkably unconvincing attempt to establish that Jeffrey McDonald was capable of slaughtering his pregnant wife and two daughters, on a whim, no less. Contrary to its intended effect, McGinnis's rehearsal of the psychiatric testimony before the grand jury gives the reader a depressing look into the fragility of the American justice system. Warheide's questions were clearly meant to solicit a pathological depiction of McDonald, and he was not above employing deception for this purpose. He suggested to one witness, Dr. Robert Sadoff, that the government was in possession of scientific proof that McDonald was guilty, and wondered if Sadoff might, in light of this ironclad print and bloodstain evidence, reconsider his original diagnosis of McDonald as falling within the psychologically normal range. When Sadoff asked, "How do you know all this?" Warheide averred, "It's like fingerprint analysis, the same principle." But this was false, and Warheide knew it. He tried the same trick on McDonald at one point, implying that the government had, by a chemical process, found McDonald's prints on rubber glove fragments recovered from the crime scene. Meanwhile, the psychiatric witnesses themselves would make any reflective reader wonder how they might fare under such free-form scrutiny. For example, the former chief of psychiatry at Walter Reed Army Hospital, a man who had examined McDonald in 1970 and found him warm, engaging, and personable, at one point recounted to the court that he had offered to put McDonald under sodium amytal and then interview him about the events of February 17th. McDonald had declined, as one might if they did not wish to relive in vivid detail the night their wife and children were slaughtered by a gang of intruders. Nevertheless, one of the grand jurors asked the witness,
"If you were in Dr. McDonald's shoes, wouldn't you agree to take this test?"
"If I were in his shoes and I implicitly believed in my innocence..."
"That's right."
"I would certainly take the test. It could only help me."
"There is no way it could harm him. I mean, mentally?"
"As I said, we might have precipitated a greater depression, but then we could treat it. That would have been the only risk, but yes, if I were in his shoes, and thank God I'm not, but if I were, and if it were offered to me, I would take the test."
"You added one element in your previous answer. If you were in his shoes, and he knew you were innocent, you wouldn't hesitate to take the test."
"That's right."
"But if you were in his shoes and you knew you had done it, would you take the sodium amytal?"
"No, sir."
Did any of the grand jurors find this exchange suspicious? The psychiatrist knew what he would do if his family had been butchered. He was able to just run a quick simulation of what that would be like and feel like, and then give a firm answer regarding the sodium amytal? Did it seem a little tone-deaf to anyone that the same psychiatrist, when asked if any damage might result from one's reliving the night their family was hacked to pieces, responded that the resulting depression could be treated? Oh, well, if you can treat the depression, then why not take the amytal? And yet McGinnis makes a point of highlighting this exchange, confident that his readers will infer something about MacDonald rather than about the grand jury proceeding. A second Army psychiatrist who testified before the grand jury speculated about MacDonald's latent homosexuality.
By homosexual desires, I don't mean he's a practicing homosexual. Far from it. But that he has that drive to be a homosexual, which he doesn't act on. He's not a homosexual, but he has homosexual desires and also certain psychopathic tendencies. That is, telling me about his extramarital affairs. Again, almost being too much of a man.
MacDonald, for the record, denies having homosexual desires, and no one has produced any evidence to the contrary. But never mind that. He told the psychiatrist about his extramarital affairs, so he is both a repressed homosexual and a psychopath. Note the coupling of those two, incidentally, homosexual and psychopath. Remember, it's 1974. The American Psychiatric Association only removed homosexuality from its Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders the prior year. One of the grand jurors found this line of analysis fruitful, nonetheless, and asked the psychiatrist,
"Would you think that a questioning or challenging of his manliness would pose the threat of setting him off?"
Challenging his manliness, in the sense of Colette maybe not liking too much his having become turned off sexually as her pregnancy began to show itself, and accusing him of, you know, not having it as a male, and that's why he doesn't want to sleep with her, yes. This guy's a Green Beret tiger in black boots. I think that would be quite a challenge.
War Heidi.
An area where he would be particularly sensitive.
Yes, sir, that's my opinion.
War Heidi's psychiatric witnesses also contradicted each other, though that didn't seem to bother him, or McGinnis, so long as their conclusions pointed to MacDonald's guilt. One found MacDonald's responses to the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory suspicious.
"My reservation is that the person who completed the questionnaire seems to have answered the questions in such a way as to present himself in the best light possible. That does not necessarily mean that he lied, but it at least indicates a certain awareness of the implications of some of the questions he was asked, and at least some attempt to present himself in the best light possible."
But another of War Heidi's psychiatric witnesses stated that MacDonald showed no indications of planning ahead in what he was saying and trying to make himself look good. Instead, he seemed to be speaking quickly, openly, frankly, and without reserve. He soon added, "More than most people, Captain MacDonald would not be very good at subtly or cleverly or consistently hiding features about his personality. He was too naive to do that." Which was it? Was MacDonald a Machiavellian, able to reverse engineer the MMPI and jam up its calculus, confounding the analysts? Or was he a simpleton, incapable of hiding his true colors for any length of time, easy pickings for any shrewd shrink? War Heidi showed little interest in such questions. However you cut it, MacDonald didn't look good, and if one witness found MacDonald suspicious because he was cunning and the other because he was credulous, what difference did that make? The point was, he was suspicious. As on the autobiographical cassette tapes that he provided to McGinnis, MacDonald, when he reappeared before the grand jury in 1975, proved to be his own worst enemy. Whereas his mood during his 1974 testimony was some combination of bewildered, scandalized, exhausted, and yet still willing to help, by the time of his return to North Carolina that January, he had pretty clearly had it with the grand jury. He regarded the proceeding as a sham, worthy of contempt, and he would make little effort to conceal these feelings. MacDonald was especially put out by any questions about his philandering, which he regarded as clearly outside the scope of any sane investigation into whether he had murdered his family. War Heidi, by contrast, regarded it as one pillar of his case, the others being MacDonald's mendacity, psychopathy, and fragile masculinity. So this time around, the womanizing questions came early. Within the first few minutes of MacDonald's taking the stand, War Heidi started in.
"As you know, when you were here before, we asked you about various girls or ladies that you knew, and one of those was Carol Larson. In the course of the investigation, we've contacted some of them. There's a name that I don't think we have mentioned to you. That is Gloria Lloyd. Do you recall her?
McDonald.
No.
Well, that's going very far back, but do you remember being employed by Montvent Inc. or Montane Ventures?
Montvent, yes, I do.
Yeah, and do you recall when that was?
No, it was summer employment, one of my years in college, I think.
Well, specifically, do you remember it was the year 1964?
No, I don't.
All right, and well, do you remember where you worked in 64?
No, I'm sure you know.
All right, well, when I mentioned Montvent Inc., does that refresh your recollection with respect to Gloria Lloyd?
Yeah, I think she was a secretary working for Montvent.
Oh, and tell us what happened.
I balled the girl. Big deal. She was a secretary.
Well, did Colette find out about this?
No, Colette didn't find out about it.
And this didn't create a problem between you and Colette?
No, it didn't.
Did Colette find out about any of the other girls?
No.
It was not the only instance of such testiness on McDonald's part. Anyone advising him might have told him to tone it down in order to make a better impression upon the grand jury. Then again, Warheide's questioning seemed at points engineered to drive McDonald up a wall. For example,
"And when you checked Colette's chest, you observed it was bloody."
"It was bloody?"
"Yeah."
"Yeah."
"And had stab wounds?"
"Yeah, I think we covered that, Mr. Warheide."
At one point, Warheide asked McDonald if he remembered hearing his pajama top rip while he was being attacked by four people in the dark, while his family's screams echoed through the apartment. You get the picture. At another point, Warheide asked McDonald if he could remember stepping in anything wet as he journeyed from room to room, encountering the bloody corpses that had been his family. To this, McDonald replied dryly, "No, I wasn't thinking about that. I'm sure you would have been." In McGinnis's narrative, Warheide's voice thunders throughout the courtroom. His questioning is subtle, yet pointed. The prosecutor gradually and gracefully hems McDonald in, like a master chess player toying with a novice. There may have been something about Warheide's courtroom presence that impressed his audience in this way. Or this version of events may have been dramatically serviceable for McGinnis. Recall that the author only met McDonald in 1979. He was not present for these events in 1974 and 75, so his stage setting in Fatal Vision was secondhand. Indeed, he may have simply consulted the transcript of the grand jury proceeding, as I have done. Whatever the case, that transcript, and particularly the printed record of the final dialogue between Warheide and McDonald in January 1975, offers little evidence of the prosecutorial masterclass McGinnis narrates for his readers in Fatal Vision. Here, for example, is Warheide attempting to paint McDonald into a corner using blood and splinter evidence.
"Okay, where would you say you were when you started bleeding as a result of the injuries you sustained, Dr. McDonald?"
I never noticed much blood on myself. I don't know."
"Well, you had all these injuries when you were lying on the floor and at one point there, did you not?"
"Uh-huh."
"Were you bleeding at that time?"
"I don't remember seeing any. I suppose I was."
"How heavily were you bleeding?"
"Well, I just told you. Apparently, you are not listening. I didn't see any blood. How could I then say I was bleeding heavily?"
"Well, at one point, you went in the bathroom and you looked at yourself in the mirror. You saw, you know, that you had some blood on you."
"Yeah."
"Did you observe that you were, in fact, bleeding?"
"No, I've told you that 10 times.
"This was blood you picked up from Colette?"
"I saw blood around my mouth."
"Well, I'm told that splinters of the club were found in the master bedroom and in each of the children's bedrooms, but none were found in the living room, particularly in this area and around here. Now, do you have any explanations as to that?"
"Well, first of all, Mr. Warheide, there's a lot of traffic up and down that hall, including a stretcher, and moved clothing, so I have no idea which time is accurate. It probably isn't. That's the first premise. The second, I have no idea. I can't answer that. It seems to me the club was used in the other rooms after it was used on me.
Well, that would mean that... What would that signify? Now, Colette and Kimberly were screaming when you awoke. That's what woke you up. And yet, at the time they were screaming, these four people were down there with the club and striking at you. And yet, it is the club that they were striking at you whose splinters are found in this room, and this room. Now, do you have any theory that explains this?
Only that it sounds to me like the club went from where I was into the other rooms.
Or perhaps the club that shed the splinters, unlike the smooth, baseball bat-like club MacDonald claimed had been wielded against him, had been in the bedrooms before MacDonald was attacked. Would this have violated some law of logic or physics? It was on the basis of such open-ended speculation that Warheide attempted to circle closer and closer to his prosecutorial prey, and finally uncork his threatened masculinity theory of the murders before the grand jury. Warheide.
Mr. Stombaugh, by careful examination of these photographs, was able to reconstruct the manner in which the pajama top was folded. He did reconstruct it. He found there were 48 ice pick penetration marks on your pajama top. And when the pajama top was folded the same way it was folded on top of Colette's body, these ice pick holes went through your pajama top and into her body. Now, can you tell us how that happened?
No, because I don't believe it. It's a lot of bullshit.
Take a look at the picture.
You can do anything you want to with 50 holes in a pajama top is what I'm trying to say, Mr. Warheide. It's a bunch of crap. If this was a legitimate investigator technique, why wasn't it done 4 years ago?
Do you have any other comment?
No, except that by my being unable to explain blood spots, you make me guilty of homicide of my family?
Well, tell me this. Did you ever at any time become enraged with Colette?
I can't remember being enraged, no. Angry, sure.
Was there anything she could have said to you at any time that might set you in a state of rage?
No.
If she had accused you of a lack of sexual competence, would that have set you in a state of rage? Or would it have had no effect whatsoever as far as you're concerned?
I can't imagine me being in a state of rage over that.
How about accusing you of a lack of masculinity?
Colette? Accusing me of that? No, I wouldn't be in a state of rage.
Now, that night, there was no argument or quarrel between you and Colette.
None, whatsoever.
And all of this evidence that I've told you about is fabricated.
Well, I don't know what to make of it, Mr. Warheide. It doesn't make any sense to me. I have told you what I know to the best of my ability, 4 years later.
Stombaugh was able to refold MacDonald's pajama top exactly as it had been folded when it lay over Colette's chest in the master bedroom. How did he manage that bit of magic? The crime scene pictures showed the garment in two different positions. One of the MPs didn't remember seeing it at all when he first laid eyes on Colette. And Warheide had proven that the holes in the pajama top aligned with Colette's ice pick wounds? We will return to this unqualified claim in a later episode. It was, believe it or not, the smoking gun evidence of MacDonald's guilt by McGinnis's lights. But for now, it is worth considering that MacDonald's reaction, that this far-fetched claim was bullshit, was perhaps the appropriate one. Contrary to McGinnis's narrative, a look through the transcript reveals that Warheide's performance before the grand jury was far from a carefully constructed case, whereby he layered inarguable evidence upon inarguable evidence until his threatened masculinity theory went from speculative to plausible to overwhelmingly probable, tightening the noose around MacDonald's neck until he panicked and snapped, perhaps just as he had snapped on the night of the murders. There is one more critical moment in MacDonald's January 1975 testimony that we need to examine. And here, listeners of The Looking Glass will learn about a topic that the literature on the MacDonald murders has said too little about. The point is sufficiently important that, arguably, the entire case hangs on it. Let's return to the grand jury. Warheide.
Now, Dr. MacDonald, you have always said it was Kristen who was wet, who was in the bed with Colette and wet the bed.
Right, it was.
A test of the urine spot indicates it was Kimberly's urine and not Kristen's urine.
Recall that Kristen was the McDonald's youngest 2-year-old daughter. Kimberly, their eldest daughter, was 5.
Well, Christy was in the bed. What do you want me to say? Jesus Christ, Christy was in the bed. She wet the bed and I put her back in her own bed. You people are crazy. I picked up Christy and I put her back in her bed.
And it was not...
It was not Kimberly.
It was not Kimberly who was in the bed.
Jesus Christ.
Well, do you have any reason for saying it was Kristen instead of Kimberly? As I say, scientific laboratory evidence...
Scientific bullshit.
Kimberly's urine?
No.
This exchange is pivotal. The prosecution's theory, all the way back to the Army investigations of the early 1970s, was that the trigger for the explosive argument between Jeffrey and Colette was the bedwetting. If the government now possessed evidence that McDonald claimed his youngest daughter had wet the bed, when really his eldest daughter had, then the government had powerful proof of McDonald's guilt. Why? For a few reasons. First, McDonald could not plausibly claim to have been mistaken about which daughter wet the bed, as his adamant denials before the grand jury made clear. He knew which daughter wet the bed. Second, that meant McDonald was lying about which daughter wet the bed. And why would he lie? The only plausible answer is that he had something to hide. What? Well, let's return to the prosecution's theory. The theory that bedwetting was a point of contention between Jeffrey and Colette increased in plausibility as the age of the bedwetter went up. A 2-year-old's wetting the bed was normal. 2-year-olds wear diapers. But a 5-year-old's wetting the bed might be a problem from a parent's perspective, as 5 is closer to the age when a child should stop wetting the bed. It follows that if McDonald, before the Army even floated the bedwetting theory, had sought to hide from investigators the fact that his eldest daughter wet the bed that night, it almost certainly pointed to a consciousness of guilt. None of the books on the McDonald case look into this matter in any detail. McGinnis simply notes,
among the findings made by Paul Stambaugh at the FBI laboratory in Washington was that the stain on the bed of Jeffrey and Colette McDonald was consistent with the urine of a person having type AB blood, the blood type of Kimberly McDonald, as opposed to the type O blood of Kristen. Warheide confronted Jeffrey with the contradiction between this fact and his statement that it had been Christy who had wet the bed the night of the murders.
McGinnis appears to have been confused about the source of the urine claim. It was not the FBI lab, but rather the CID lab, and the claim dated to 1971, during the CID's reinvestigation of the murders. Janice Gleason, the CID lab's head of serology, claimed to have detected blood group antigens in the urine stain on the master bed, which revealed that the urine had not come from someone with type O blood, Kristen's, but rather from someone with either type A, Colette's, or type AB, Kimberly's, blood. Yet, an FBI report of 8 years later stated that the Bureau's own, much more sophisticated laboratory lacked the technology to detect blood group antigens in urine stains. The report is dated August 23, 1979. It reads in part, this report will confirm the telephone conversation between Departmental Attorney Brian Murtaugh and Special Agent, redacted, on August 6, 1979. The serological examinations in this matter were conducted by Special Agent, redacted. Specimens Q131, Q135, and Q136 were identified by Departmental Attorney Murtaugh as urine stains on bedsheet material. Since no conclusive methods of analysis for blood group antigens in urine stains are currently available to this laboratory, no examination of these specimens was conducted. No conclusive methods for deriving blood type from urine stains were available to the FBI lab in 1979, but they were available 8 years earlier to the Army CID lab? And why were the urine stains on Colette's bedsheet being considered for examination in 1979 when they had supposedly already been examined conclusively in 1971? McDonald may well have been correct in declaring that this was bullshit, not science. At the end of all the questioning, McDonald was again given the opportunity to speak at length to the grand jurors regarding his thoughts about the investigations that had led to his appearance before them. Warheide.
All right, will you please state what you have in mind?
McDonald.
Well, you asked me this morning if I had any comments relative to the investigation, and I do. I think this grand jury ought to know how this case has been investigated. Since you like newspapers, Mr. Warheide, I have here a newspaper clipping from December 1974 from Newsday about the graves of my wife and children. I'd like the grand jury to take a look at it. It's indicative of how the case has been investigated from beginning to end, Mr. Warheide. Nothing. No one asked the husband or the father if these graves should be opened or could they be opened. What you did was you son of a bitches paid off 6 grave diggers $50 apiece not to say anything. And I'd just like to put that in evidence because that's exactly how the whole goddamn case has been handled.
Well, we'll mark this as McDonald Exhibit 31.
I'd also like to say for the record that I don't appreciate you lying to and badgering my relatives in order to get some testimony from them. Specifically, I'd like to say that my sister was told that the only time that Dr. McDonald broke down and cried was discussing the sodium amytal interview. Now that's an absurd allegation. If you were sitting in this room when I was sitting here last August, it doesn't seem right to me.
Who allegedly made the statement to her?
That creep that works for you, that little viper.
All right.
The little guy who doesn't have enough politeness to introduce himself or doesn't know any of the social amenities.
McDonald here referred to Brian Murtaugh, an Army lawyer who became convinced of McDonald's guilt on the basis of the Second Army investigation into the murders, and who continued pursuing the case when he transferred to the Justice Department.
There's been a lot of comments made about my sexual proclivities through the case, Mr. Warheide. Apparently sleeping around isn't left just to Dr. McDonald. I'd just like to relate an instance as to how this case gets investigated. A girl that I met after I was out of the Army and in New York was investigated by the FBI. And he spent about an hour beating around the bush, and finally she said, look, what you're trying to say is how was Dr. McDonald in bed, right? And he said, that's right. And she told him, and they talked for a little while longer, and then he asks her out. She called me and tells me this, and I was absolutely astounded. An FBI agent asks out a potential witness in a homicide case? So then she went and contacted her attorney. She felt a little unsure about how to handle that. So he said, well, if he ever contacts you, make sure all your meetings are down in the FBI office. And he called back and said that he had to have another meeting, that it was imperative. And she said, fine, we'll meet in the FBI office. And he said, that's okay, we don't need the meeting. That's just a little aside, it's not important, nothing to do with the facts of the case. It's just indicative of how the case has been handled from the beginning to end. Then I'd like to, well, there's a lot I'd like to say, but what I'm going to do, if it's okay with you, so I'll make some sense instead of yelling and screaming like I did last time, I just like to sort of make my statement, which I wrote.
Please do.
Which I wrote on the plane. This, of course, was with the help of my attorneys. Okay, this is me, but they edited it and said, you shouldn't say that and you do say this, what they always waste lunch hours doing. It's been 5 years since my life collapsed, when my family was murdered. I tried to start over. Now I'm reading this, this is obvious. I'm not gonna speak off the cuff because I wanted to say too much. I tried to start over again in California. Some people, Mr. Warheide, Colonel Pruitt, my father-in-law, they don't seem to understand how hard it's been for me. They seem to feel that because I moved away from New York, away from the graves, somehow I don't love my family, and I don't miss them, and I faked everything about the murders. This means, of course, that I never cared for my family at all. And of course, that leads to that I must have killed them. The last time I was here in August, and this time I tried to answer your questions. I have told you as much as I know, except in regards to attorney work products that Mr. Siegel says I shouldn't talk about. I wish I knew more of your questions, especially today. I wish I knew why it happened. I wish I knew who killed Colette, Christy, and Kimmy. I do pretty well most of the time. I wish I could tell the grand jury the answers to all the questions Mr. Warheide has been raising for 5 or 6 months. These are questions that I have had to live with for 5 years. I have had to accept that I may never know what happened. It's not easy to live with that. The whole explanation, but it's really all I can do. What I wanted to tell you about was what my life has been like now since the 17th of February. That, to bother Mr. Kassab and Mr. Warheide and Mr. Stroud and everyone else. They all seem to think that I just walked away from Colette and Kimmy and Chris. And that shows I couldn't have cared for them. They all seem to think that if I never cared for my girls, I could have killed them. And then going out to California and bought a car and a boat and forgot all about it. Well, that's not true. People want to know why I don't spend all my time crying on other people's shoulders. Why I don't break down. Is he cold? Doesn't he have any feelings? Wouldn't that show more of my love? Let's start with the newspaper interviews and the Dick Cavett show. My mother, my brother, and my sister, they all tell me that when they were here, they were asked at length why I did those interviews. And yet, why didn't I ever talk about the killings to anyone else, including the family? No one questioned me about it. I'm not going to talk about it for no reason. And the reason I went on the Dick Cavett show is because a congressman called me and asked me to go on. And I also know that a lot of people don't believe me. I have a right to try and live and try to get this statement out once and for all. So I did two things. I talked to Time Magazine and I talked to the Dick Cavett show. You know, the upshot is I was trying to not have to spend the rest of my life explaining to everyone that meets me. In the confusion of the time, I thought that if I said it once loudly, maybe that I wouldn't have to continually, you know, reply to those questions. I don't find it very easy to beg for sympathy. Every time I tell the story of February 17th, I die a little bit. I'm ashamed that I couldn't help my family, but I tried. I'm the one that hears Colette and Kimmy. I can't keep talking about that. You expect me to talk about it over coffee to everyone that comes by, or I'm not normal. The grand jury, except for my lawyers, the grand jury and Colonel Rock are the only three people who ever heard the whole story. My lawyers never really heard the whole story until I was in front of Colonel Rock. I mean, never in detail, at once in one sitting. In bits and pieces, it's so different when you're talking about it later. You make it sound like we are supposed to be sitting and talking about it constantly. The only one that I know that does that is Freddie. So I don't spend a lot of time talking about it. I don't tell everyone I meet. I don't tell all my friends. I didn't tell anyone the whole story. That doesn't seem normal to me. And yet you make it sound the other way. You make it sound like it's abnormal that I don't go around telling everyone, saying, hey, let me tell you about Fort Bragg, 1970. That brings me to Freddie. He feels, I guess, that I never told them the full story, and I didn't. He also feels that I lied to him when I told him about these stupid, pathetic attempts to find the real killers. He's partially right, but he's partially wrong, too. I never did sit down with him and tell him the whole story. But contrary to implications that he keeps leaving, he was apprised of everything. We were in daily contact. He knew exactly what was being said all through the Article 32, and then I gave him a copy of the Article 32. And it isn't as though later or a couple years later, it sounds like Jesus. He never knew what was going on, and he never heard. He heard daily. He talked to Bernie and Denny and Jim Duluth and Mike Malley and myself all the time. He knew exactly what was going on. I never just decided to just go over to his house and sit down and start telling him again. He never asked. For one, my friends never asked. You know, my family has never asked me. My mother has never said to me, what happened? It seems to be one of my major sins that I don't talk about it all the time. Freddie was a funny kind of friend. All through the Article 32, he was my devoted supporter. He was proclaiming my innocence the loudest. He said that he would be the only one, or he would have been the first to know if anything was wrong between Colette and me. Even if we never told him, because he was so close, he knew we were happy. Freddie was the hardest person for me to talk to later because of that. I mean, he made a very dramatic and nice testimony for me at the Article 32. And then it was hard to sit around and talk with Mildred about comparing the prettiness of her respective grandchildren. And who should have been killed? How do you expect me to talk to a person like that? Then, at the end of the Article 32, here I'm in this obligation to Freddy. I'm supposed to devote my whole life to the night of the 17th and spend the rest of my life forging through North Carolina. One man FBI. Well, I can't do it. And I knew I couldn't do it, and I lied to him. I told him that. I was ashamed that, well, I'm ashamed now, I told him. I was ashamed as soon as I told him. I'm ashamed I didn't die that night. And that sounds stupid to you, I know. So here I was trying to prove that, especially to Freddy, you know, that I would do the best I can. So I do this little fantasy bit. Well, that's over. We've talked about it. So I try to satisfy him. Ah, shit. This is not making sense even reading it. I'm sorry I told Freddy about it. This doesn't make any sense. So now I'm up to the winter of 1970-71, and I'm in New York trying to practice medicine, waiting for my residency at Yale to start in June of 71, trying to carry on my life. But you've got to understand that this was a life that Colette and I had planned. Colette and I were supposed to go to Yale and get a farm, and I was supposed to be a hotshot orthopedic surgeon and live on a farm with the kids. I can't keep that dream going without Colette and the kids. So I go out to California. So what? There's no crime in that. Essentially, to paraphrase all these pages that I'm turning, you know, I just had to change my life. So I go out there and work with Jerry Hughes, a friend of mine from the Army. A different kind of life. I don't expect Brian Murtaugh to understand that. Maybe the grand jury will. Right now, in California, I'm director of the emergency department. After I left here in August, they made me director. Big deal. They called me in and they said, despite what's happening, we still like you. And I said, big fucking deal. You don't have to like me. And they said, no, you're doing a good job and we want to make you director. So I'm director now. Well, it's a busy emergency room. A lot of car accidents and heart attacks and gunshots and stabbings. I work very hard. And I work on purpose. I've got to work. I stay busy, see a lot of people. I'm exhausted. I work a 12-hour shift. I make a lot of money. Okay, I don't work hard to make a lot of money. That's not my goal in life. I make a lot of money, so I spend a lot. That's another crime. This sounds really trite. I like emergency medicine, you know? I help a lot of people. It makes me feel a little useful, you know? I didn't do enough to save my family. And then you come in here and you say someone folded the top of my pajama top and put little probes through it, and that means I killed Colette? I mean, what can I say about that? These arguments about other women are just, they are absurd. I've slept with a lot of women. It doesn't mean anything to me at all. It never has meant anything to me. It's been very easy for me my whole life. I haven't chased one girl in California, and I must have slept with 30 since I've been there. Because I didn't spend the rest of my life, you know, praying on the graves, you tell me I don't love my family, and that means I must have killed them. That's not true. Oh, it's a lot of shit. I didn't kill Colette, and I didn't kill Kimmy, and I didn't kill Christy. And I didn't move Colette, and I didn't move Kimmy, and I didn't move Christy. And I gave them mouth-to-mouth breathing. And I loved them then, and I love them now. And Colette didn't kill them either. And you can shove all your fucking evidence right up your ass.
Dr. McDonald, we have gone into certain matters because we have had to go into those matters.
Sure.
You were examined by a psychiatrist, your own psychologist. You were examined by the Army psychiatrist and psychologist. And you know when psychologists and psychiatrists probe into your personality and state of mind, they inevitably focus on your sex life and how that affects your family life.
Yeah, I'd like to probe into some of the psychiatrist's sex life, you know?
Yeah. Now, do you recall telling any psychiatrist or psychologist that you had a sense of relief after your family was gone? That because you felt the sense of relief from the fact that you no longer had those responsibilities, you were a little bit ashamed.
Well, the comment, I don't know if it was to Bailey or Sadoff, the comment, we were talking about dreams, you know, we were talking about shame. And I was crying or something, I don't know. And he said, what are you crying about? And I said, I'm ashamed. And he said, what for? And I said, occasionally I have a feeling, you know, that I have no more responsibilities. And I was ashamed of the feeling. And he said, it's not an abnormal feeling. And I said, well, I'm very, very ashamed of that. And I am. And I occasionally get it, you know, I feel guilty every time I have a good time. You know that? Every time I have a good time, I pay an equal price. If I have a good day in the emergency room, I have to spend some time by myself to sort of recuperate because I shouldn't have been having a good time. Because I should have died. Does that make any sense? That's what that was in reference to.
Dr. McDonald, you made specific reference in your statement concerning the pajama top and the probes that went through it that matched up in their pattern with the stab wounds in Colette's chest. How about the story that's told by that sheet? Let's talk about that.
Here, Warheide referred to evidence that he put to McDonald and the grand jurors, which purported to reveal that McDonald had wrapped Colette in a sheet taken from the bed in the master bedroom. Why would he have done that? Well, according to the theory of the crime that the FBI's Paul Stombaugh presented to the grand jury, McDonald had, as the original investigator surmised, gotten into a fight with Colette in the master bedroom. It had grown violent, with not only Jeffrey striking Colette, but with Colette striking Jeffrey in the head with a slab of wood. Kimberly, the couple's eldest daughter, had heard the commotion, run into the master bedroom, and been struck herself by McDonald, either accidentally or intentionally. The blow knocked her out. Once McDonald had beaten Colette unconscious, he carried Kimberly back to her bedroom and placed her in her bed. He then beat her to death. He next entered little Kristen's room, but by the time he got there, Colette had reawakened and, anticipating his murderous intentions, raced into Kristen's room to protect her. McDonald then beat Colette to death in Kristen's room before killing Kristen herself. It was at this point that he wrapped Colette in the bedsheet and carried her back into the master bedroom, laid her on the floor, and then inflicted the post-mortem stab wounds that he would later attribute to imaginary intruders. This scenario was supposedly supported by bloodstain evidence, which had been relatively easy to sort because, as luck would have it, each member of the McDonald family had a different blood type. This was how investigators were able to determine that, for example, Colette had bled in Kristen's room, not just her own.
I have no idea what that even means, Mr. Warheide. You know, you tell me you have an expert in impressions. He comes in and says that a body was put on there a certain way. I don't know what that means. I don't have any idea.
It's like a fingerprint, Dr. McDonald.
I don't believe that, first of all.
You take a fingerprint and you compare it with an unknown print. And if the fingerprint that you take matches in its details, the ridge lines, the whorls.
Yeah, right.
With the unknown print, then you know that this fingerprint was made by the same finger. Now, you take a sheet that's been laid over a body wearing clothing that is soaked in blood, and if the pattern of the clothing and the pattern of the blood spots is transferred to the sheet, you can make the same identification that you can with the fingerprint.
Well, that sounds like a much more inexact science to me. I never even heard of it, neither had Mr. Siegel.
All right, now, this sheet has transferred to it impressions made by Colette's clothing, soaked in blood, and by your clothing, soaked in Colette's blood.
I was lying against Colette, Mr. Warheide, that's all I know. I didn't even see a sheet. Maybe a sheet was something that I was pulling off a chair or off the bed to lay on her, but I don't remember that at all. I don't remember seeing a sheet even.
It has your handprints on it.
All right, so they are on it, but I don't know. I told you what I know. I gave her mouth-to-mouth breathing, and I tried to cover her with something, and that's all I know. I didn't move my wife. I moved her off a green chair. That was all I did.
Dr. McDonald, I was informed by Mr. Siegel that you are planning on a skiing trip. Is that right?
No, that had to be canceled. I canceled it.
I see. So you are not planning to take any trip in the immediate future?
No.
It was a prescient decision. Within a week, the grand jury would indict Jeffrey McDonald for the murders of Colette, Kimberly, and Kristen.